From a small, rural village in the Eastern Cape to the world stage, his name would come to mean hope, love, and reconciliation. Born Rolihlahla. Troublemaker Mandela in 1918 among the Tembu royal family, he grew into a lawyer turned revolutionary who dared to challenge a brutal apartheid regime. For 27 years, he endured imprisonment, but emerged determined to build a multiracial democracy for South Africa. His willingness to forgive violent oppressors and unite a fractured nation reshaped modern history. In this 7-chapter documentary, we explore every step on that long walk to freedom. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Roots in Mvezo. I am not a saint, unless you think of a saint as a sinner who keeps on trying. Nelson Mandela. The story begins in a small village nestled in the green hills of the Eastern Cape of South Africa, a place called Mvezo. The year was 1918. On July 18th, a baby boy was born to the Tembu royal family of the Xhosa Nation. He was given the name Rolihlahla Mandela. In Xhosa, Rolihlahla means pulling the branch of a tree, but more loosely, it meant troublemaker. No one knew then just how fitting that name would become. Mandela was born into a lineage of leadership. His father, Gadla Henry Mfakanyiswa, was a respected chief and counselor to the Tembu king. Though his title would later be stripped by colonial authorities, his dignity and authority shaped young Mandela's understanding of justice, tradition, and resistance. His mother, Nosekeni Fani, belonged to a different royal clan, giving Mandela both spiritual grounding and cultural depth. As a boy, Mandela was not born into poverty, but neither did he live a life of privilege. His family lived in a modest rondavel, one-room huts made of mud and thatch, with few possessions but deep heritage. As a child, Mandela spent long afternoons herding cattle, listening to elders tell stories by firelight, and learning the oral history of his people. These stories were more than tales. They were lifelines. They spoke of heroes who fought for land, honor, and freedom. They warned of colonial invaders and reminded young boys of the dignity of service to the people. At age 7, Mandela was sent to a Methodist school. It was there that a teacher gave him the name Nelson, following the British custom of assigning Christian names to African students. He never knew why that name was chosen. It was just part of the silent cultural erasure embedded in the colonial system. But even as he adopted a Western name, Mandela never abandoned his African roots. When his father died from an untreated lung disease, Mandela's life changed. He was only 9 years old. As per custom, he was sent to live with the regent of the Tembu people, Chief Yongentaba Dalindyebo, in the town of Mhekezweni. It was there, in the royal household, that Mandela's understanding of leadership, discipline, and duty was forged. Mhekezweni was where he first encountered the tension between African tradition and Western rule. Mandela listened intently as the regent held tribal councils, where decisions were made through consensus. He saw how leadership was built not by command, but by respect. Yet outside those walls, apartheid was taking shape. Black South Africans had no vote, no land, and no voice. Mandela was beginning to understand the divide. He attended the local mission school and later moved on to the prestigious Clarkberry Boarding Institute, then Healdtown, and eventually the University College of Fort Hare, one of the few higher learning institutions for black South Africans. It was at Fort Hare that Mandela tasted political resistance for the first time. In his second year, he participated in a student protest over the unfair treatment of students by the administration. The protest was small but powerful. When the university demanded he apologize, he refused. He was expelled. That decision, though hard, marked a turning point. It was the beginning of a life defined by principle. Mandela was no longer just a royal son. He was becoming a rebel. After Fort Hare, he returned to the royal home, only to discover that the regent had arranged a marriage for him. Mandela, unwilling to accept a life dictated for him, ran away to Johannesburg with his cousin Justice. They arrived with almost nothing. Mandela worked as a night watchman, then as a clerk, eventually finding work with a liberal white law firm. He enrolled in correspondence courses at the University of South Africa and began studying law at the University of the Witwatersrand. It was in Johannesburg that the true fire of political awakening began to burn. Here, he encountered the harsh realities of urban segregation, pass laws, racial classifications, police harassment. These weren't just policies, they were cages. Johannesburg was both a prison and a forge. It hardened him, shaped him, and connected him with others who would change the course of South African history. Among them was Walter Sisulu, a real estate agent and activist, who became both mentor and lifelong friend. Through Sisulu, Mandela joined the African National Congress, ANC, in 1943. The ANC was old, but it was changing. Young activists like Mandela, Oliver Tambo, and Anton Lembede founded the ANC Youth League, pushing the organization toward bold action. No more petitions. No more quiet compromise. This first chapter ends with a moment of reflection. Mandela standing on a Johannesburg rooftop, watching the sunset over a city divided by race but alive with resistance. He had left behind the rolling hills of the Eastern Cape and the life of a quiet village boy. Ahead lay struggle, prison, and a revolution that would span decades. But in that moment, with the wind rising and the city lights flickering on below, Mandela understood something deeper than words. He was no longer just Roli Lahla, the troublemaker. He was becoming a symbol. Not of chaos, but of change. Chapter 2. The Fire Within. In the 1940s, Johannesburg was boiling beneath the surface. Officially, the city was expanding under modern industry and white prosperity. But behind every new building, every office tower, and every gold mine, there was a system built on injustice. Black South Africans were being forced into segregated townships, stripped of their rights, and locked into a life of hard labor and constant surveillance. The legal system was not a shield for the people. It was a weapon used against them. It was in this city, this powder keg, that Nelson Mandela stepped into his purpose. After joining the African National Congress in 1943, Mandela quickly saw that the old methods, polite petitions and formal appeals, were no longer enough. South Africa's white minority government wasn't listening. They were building something worse: apartheid, a full system of legalized racial segregation. Alongside fiery young leaders like Anton Lembede, Walter Sisulu, and Oliver Tambo, Mandela co-founded the ANC Youth League. Their mission was clear: make the ANC militant, bold, and rooted in African pride. They believed in mass action, civil disobedience, and complete self-determination. No one was coming to save them. they would save themselves. Mandela's charisma was magnetic. Tall, sharp-witted, and confident, he could speak to crowds like a preacher and debate in the courtroom like a scholar. But he wasn't only eloquent. He was fearless. When the government passed the Suppression of Communism Act, Mandela and the Youth League didn't retreat. They planned more action. In 1952, the ANC launched the Defiance Campaign. It was the first coordinated national protest against apartheid laws. Volunteers across the country deliberately broke racial laws, sitting in whites-only train cars, using European-only entrances, and refusing to carry passbooks. Nelson Mandela was appointed National Volunteer-in-Chief. He led by example, walking into whites-only areas and daring the police to arrest him. They did. Mandela was arrested and sentenced to 9 months in prison, suspended for 2 years. But that didn't silence him. If anything, it made him stronger. The campaign drew thousands of new recruits and caught the attention of the world. For the first time, apartheid was being named and shamed in global headlines. But resistance came at a cost. Mandela's law firm, Mandela and Tambo, which he had co-founded with Oliver Tambo, was constantly watched by police. Clients were harassed. Phones were tapped. At home, things were falling apart. His first marriage to Evelyn Mace, a nurse and devout Jehovah's Witness, couldn't survive the strain. They eventually divorced. Still, Mandela kept moving forward. His legal work gave him unique power. While many activists were behind bars, he remained free, fighting in court by day, planning revolution by night. In 1955, the ANC and its allies gathered to write the Freedom Charter, a radical document calling for democracy, equal rights, land reform, and shared wealth. South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white, it declared. The government responded with fear. In 1956, Mandela and 155 others were arrested and charged with treason. The treason trial would drag on for nearly 5 years. Every day, Mandela stood in court, facing possible execution, with his life in the balance. Yet he used that time to organize, build solidarity, and train his mind. He read legal briefs and political theory. He practiced his arguments. He never showed fear. Outside the courtroom, Mandela began to see that nonviolent protest was not enough. The government was not simply stubborn, it was brutal. Police massacred peaceful protesters, raided homes, banned newspapers, and tortured activists. After the 1960 Sharpeville massacre, in which police gunned down 69 black South Africans, something inside Mandela shifted forever. This chapter marks that turning point. Mandela had once believed in peaceful protest as the only way. But how do you fight a regime that fires into unarmed crowds, that jails children, that burns homes for holding a banned pamphlet? Mandela knew the stakes. If they continued on this path, they might be slaughtered. But if they did nothing, they would be erased. So he made a decision, quietly, strategically. He began exploring the idea of armed resistance. The fire within him was no longer just anger. It was resolve. He would not be a martyr. He would be a warrior. Not for revenge, but for freedom. And that fire would soon become something far more dangerous, a movement that could shake the pillars of apartheid to their core. Chapter 3, The Black Pimpernel. By the early 1960s, South Africa had become a pressure cooker. The peaceful resistance movement, once grounded in civil disobedience and legal challenge, was met with violence, death, and imprisonment. The state had banned the ANC. The leaders were scattered, imprisoned, or underground. The police were everywhere, armed and brutal, and the noose around black communities was tightening. For Nelson Mandela, it was clear the old tools of change were no longer enough. So in 1961, with the support of the ANC leadership, Mandela co-founded Umkhonto we Sizwe, Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the movement. It was a historic shift. They would not begin with terror, but with sabotage. Infrastructure, not people, would be the targets. Railway lines, power stations, and government buildings would be bombed, not to kill, but to disrupt and send a message. We are here. We will not go quietly. Mandela knew this would make him a wanted man. He shaved his hair, changed his clothes, and slipped into the shadows. Moving between safe houses, sometimes dressed as a chauffeur, other times as a gardener, he became unrecognizable, even to his closest friends. Journalists began calling him the Black Pimpernel, a nod to the fictional hero who evaded capture with cunning and flair. But this was no game. Mandela lived in constant danger. The security police had doubled their forces. Every known activist was being watched. Every movement tracked. Mandela's family, his new wife, Winnie, and their two young daughters lived under near-permanent surveillance. The strain was enormous, but Mandela believed the cause was greater than comfort, greater even than family. In 1962, using forged documents, he left South Africa for the first time. His mission? Secure support from African liberation movements and build a network for armed training. He visited Ethiopia, Algeria, Ghana, and Tanzania, meeting revolutionaries and presidents, learning guerrilla warfare, and raising funds. He trained in weapons, sabotage, and military strategy. He was no longer just a lawyer or protester. He was a soldier of freedom. But when Mandela returned home later that year, the government was waiting. On August 5, 1962, police pulled over a vehicle outside Howick, KwaZulu-Natal. Mandela was inside, dressed as a chauffeur. He was arrested and charged, not for sabotage, not yet, but for inciting workers to strike and leaving the country illegally. The trial was swift. Mandela was sentenced to 5 years in prison. It seemed the regime had won, but Mandela wasn't done. While he sat behind bars, the police raided a farm in Rivonia, just outside Johannesburg. It was called Lily's Leaf, and it had served as the underground headquarters of Umkhonto we Sizwe. There they found documents, blueprints for sabotage, and a diary in Mandela's handwriting. They now had everything they needed. Nelson Mandela and 10 others were charged with sabotage, conspiracy, and attempting to overthrow the government. The trial began in 1963 and became known around the world as the Rivonia Trial. The punishment could only be one thing: death. But Mandela had already made peace with that possibility. On the first day of the trial, he delivered a speech that would echo through time. Calm, defiant, and unwavering, he told the court, "I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony. It is an ideal for which I am prepared to die." Silence followed. Even the judge, a man loyal to the apartheid regime, appeared shaken. The trial dragged on for months. International outrage grew louder. The United Nations condemned the apartheid government. protesters filled streets in London, New York, and Lagos. The world demanded freedom for Mandela, but the government refused to bend. Then on June 12, 1964, the verdict came in: guilty. But the sentence was not death. Instead, Mandela and seven others were sentenced to life imprisonment. The state, perhaps fearing global consequences, had chosen to lock him away, forever. Mandela was sent to Robben Island, a wind-whipped rock off the coast of Cape Town, a place designed to break men. Cold cells, hard labor, bare feet on gravel, and silence. As he stepped onto the boat that would take him away, Mandela turned one last time to the courtroom. He didn't say a word, but in his eyes, there was no fear, only purpose. He was no longer just a man. He was a symbol, a shadow that even prison bars couldn't contain. Chapter 4, The Island Years. Robben Island is surrounded by freezing waters and jagged rocks. To the South African apartheid regime, it was the perfect place to bury a man they feared, not for violence, but for his voice. When Nelson Mandela stepped off the ferry in 1964, he was 46 years old. His sentence? Life. His cell? A tiny 8-foot by 7-foot concrete box with a mat on the floor, a metal bucket, and no running water. The goal was clear. Strip him of everything. Dignity, hope, and purpose. But Robben Island would not break him. Mandela and his fellow political prisoners were forced into hard labor in a limestone quarry under the scorching sun. Day after day, they broke rocks with hammers until their hands bled. The glare from the white stone was so intense that many prisoners, including Mandela, suffered permanent damage to their eyesight. They weren't even allowed sunglasses. Communication was tightly controlled. Prisoners were forbidden to talk while working, forbidden to study, forbidden to read anything not approved by prison authorities. But rules, like walls, could be climbed. In time, Mandela and the other ANC leaders created a network behind bars. They established what would become known as the Robben Island University. Lessons were passed in whispers, lectures delivered in the laundry room, and scraps of political writing hidden under floor tiles. They debated, argued, taught each other law, history, and strategy. In silence, they prepared for the future. Mandela used his time not just to learn, but to lead. He studied Afrikaans, the language of his jailers, not to assimilate, but to understand them. He read Shakespeare, memorized lines from Julius Caesar, and used the power of words to keep his mind sharp. His favorite quote: "Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once." His influence among the prisoners grew. Even the wardens began to take note. While many of the guards were cruel, some began to respect Mandela's calm and dignity. He greeted them politely, refused to beg, and never allowed hate to consume him. He also stood up for others. When food rations were cut, he protested. When inmates were denied blankets in the cold winters, he demanded them. Slowly, conditions improved, not because the prison changed, but because Mandela forced it to, without violence, without fear. His personal life, however, was a different kind of prison. He was allowed one 30-minute visit every 6 months. Letters from his family were heavily censored. His wife, Winnie Mandela, was herself constantly harassed, detained, and banned from public speaking. Their children grew up without him. At one point, he was even denied the chance to attend the funeral of his mother, and later, his son. The pain of absence was sharp, but he bore it quietly. He understood that his suffering wasn't private. It was political. Over the years, Mandela's legend grew. While the apartheid government tried to erase his name from history, students in Soweto chanted it during protests. Protesters in London, Paris, and New York carried signs reading, "Free Nelson Mandela." International pressure intensified. Cultural icons like Stevie Wonder, Muhammad Ali, and The Clash spoke out for his release. In 1985, the government offered Mandela a deal. Renounce the armed struggle, and you can walk free. Mandela's reply was swift and clear. I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated. He stayed. 27 years in total, more than 9,800 days. Through every one, Mandela kept his mind focused and his spirit unbroken. His refusal to compromise, even when freedom was dangled in front of him, made him a global icon of resistance and principle. But by the late 1980s, change was coming. The apartheid government, under increasing global sanctions, economic collapse, and civil unrest, began secret negotiations. Mandela, still a prisoner, was moved to Polsmore Prison and later to Victor Verster Prison. He was no longer just an inmate. He was a key to the country's future. In his final years behind bars, Mandela met with government ministers and eventually with President P.W. Botha's successor, F.W. de Klerk. Their conversations were quiet, tense, and historic. Behind closed doors, two former enemies began to chart a path toward the impossible, a peaceful transition of power. On February 11, 1990, the gates of Victor Verster Prison opened. Nelson Mandela walked out, tall, composed, and smiling. He raised a clenched fist to the sky. Not in anger, in triumph. After 27 years in prison, he had emerged not as a broken man, but as a statesman. Calm, wise, focused, and ready to lead. Chapter 5, The Negotiator, February 11th, 1990. Nelson Mandela emerged from Victor Verster Prison with a calm dignity that stunned the world. He was 71 years old. His fist raised, his step steady, his expression composed. After 27 years behind bars, he had every right to be angry, but there was no rage. There was only purpose. Crowds had gathered in Cape Town. Journalists swarmed. Supporters wept. The man who had become a global symbol of resistance was free. But freedom was not the end of the struggle. It was the beginning of a new and far more dangerous battle. How to transform South Africa without tearing it apart. Mandela returned to a country on the edge. Apartheid was still law. The African National Congress had been unbanned, but tensions ran high. Townships were burning. Political violence between rival liberation movements, particularly the ANC and the Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party, was spreading. White supremacists, police units, and intelligence operatives were fanning the flames. Civil war was no longer a distant fear. It was a real possibility. Mandela's mission had shifted. He was no longer just a freedom fighter. He was now a negotiator, a bridge between past and future. Only 9 days after his release, Mandela stood before a massive crowd in Cape Town and delivered a message that shocked many. Let there be no misunderstanding. The armed struggle is not over. It will continue until the people are free. It was bold. But in private, Mandela was already preparing for something else, talks. He knew that fighting might win battles, but only negotiation could win a nation. Throughout 1990 and 1991, Mandela led the ANC's efforts in CODESA, the Convention for a Democratic South Africa. Across the table sat President F.W. de Klerk and representatives of a regime that had imprisoned and tortured countless black South Africans. The meetings were tense. There were shouting matches, walkouts, and accusations. But Mandela never lost focus. He knew how to read a room. He spoke softly, but firmly. He listened more than he talked. He made it clear. The days of white minority rule were ending, and the country's only chance at survival was through democracy. Behind the scenes, Mandela faced challenges from within his own camp. Younger activists were growing impatient. The townships wanted faster change, immediate justice. Mandela understood their frustration. He had been a radical once, too. But now, as a leader of millions, he had to think long-term. He also faced personal pain. His marriage to Winnie Mandela had suffered. While Mandela had been in prison, Winnie had become a powerful figure in the struggle, but her methods were sometimes militant and controversial. Allegations of violence and human rights abuses swirled around her inner circle. The pressure mounted. In 1992, the two announced their separation. It was a painful decision, but Mandela understood something important. He was not just a husband. He was the future president of South Africa, and that required difficult sacrifices. That same year, tragedy struck again. The Boipatong Massacre. In June 1992, armed men killed 45 black residents in a township, most of them ANC supporters. Many believed it was carried out by members of the Inkatha Party with backing from rogue apartheid forces. Mandela was furious. He suspended negotiations. The country teetered once again on the brink. But even then, Mandela didn't let rage guide him. He regrouped. He met with the grieving. He held press conferences calling for peace. And when the time was right, he returned to the negotiating table. The breakthrough came in 1993. Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk agreed to hold South Africa's first fully democratic election. They set a date, April 27, 1994. The country would vote. Every man and woman, regardless of race, would have a say. That same year, both men were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Two enemies standing side by side, shaking hands in front of the world. It was a powerful image, but behind it was the truth. Mandela had negotiated peace not out of weakness, but out of vision. He had turned decades of suffering into the foundation for a new nation. Still, not everyone embraced the change. White extremist groups planned sabotage. Some regions declared independence. Bombs exploded in cities. Mandela even survived an assassination attempt. Yet his message never changed. He urged calm, unity, and hope. As the election drew closer, something incredible happened. For the first time in South African history, long lines began to form at polling stations. Black, white, Indian, colored, poor, and rich. They stood for hours in the sun, waiting to vote, waiting to make history. And then, on April 27th, 1994, the dream became real. Nelson Mandela, once branded a terrorist, cast his vote for the first time in his life. He was 75 years old. Chapter 6, A President for All, May 10, 1994. Pretoria. The sun rose over the Union buildings as thousands gathered to witness history. Foreign dignitaries, heads of state, and ordinary South Africans stood side by side. The air was thick with emotion, songs, ululations, laughter, and tears. After more than 3 centuries of colonialism and nearly 50 years of apartheid, South Africa was swearing in its first black president. Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela stepped up to the podium, wearing a simple dark suit. His presence was steady. His voice was calm. But his words thundered through the soul of a nation. Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. With those words, the journey from prisoner to president was complete. But the hardest work was only beginning. Mandela inherited a country bruised, broken, and deeply divided. The economy was fragile. Racial distrust was everywhere. Many black South Africans expected quick change, land, jobs, justice. Many white South Africans feared revenge, collapse, or civil war. Mandela had to lead both. He built his cabinet from all corners of society, ANC members, communists, even National Party officials who had once defended apartheid. It was not out of weakness. It was strategic. Mandela knew that to build a new South Africa, he needed unity, not purges. One of his most powerful tools was forgiveness. Instead of trials and executions, Mandela supported the creation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, TRC, led by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Its mission was not to forget the past, but to confront it openly, honestly, and with compassion. Victims of apartheid crimes told their stories. Perpetrators came forward, confessed, and if deemed truthful, were granted amnesty. The world watched in awe. It wasn't perfect. It didn't fix everything. But it gave people a voice. And sometimes, that is the first step toward healing. Still, Mandela knew that symbols matter as much as systems. In 1995, South Africa hosted the Rugby World Cup. Rugby had long been a symbol of white Afrikaner pride. Most black South Africans had no connection to the sport. The national team, the Springboks, was seen as a legacy of oppression. But Mandela saw an opportunity. He met with the team's captain, François Pienaar, and urged the nation to support the team, not because of its past, but because of what it could represent. He even wore a Springbok jersey with Pienaar's number during the final match. The moment was electric. South Africa won the World Cup. But the real victory came when the crowd, mostly white, chanted, "Nelson! Nelson! Nelson!" In that moment, Mandela did something no policy ever could. He made people believe in a shared identity, not just black, not just white, but South African. His presidency, from 1994 to 1999, was marked by restraint, reconciliation, and dignity. He pushed for housing, clean water, and electricity for the poor. He championed education and worked to fight the growing HIV/AIDS epidemic. He traveled the world, advocating for peace in Burundi, Cuba, and the Middle East. But Mandela also knew when to step back. In 1999, after just one term, he chose not to run again. He handed over power peacefully to his successor, Thabo Mbeki, setting a rare example on a continent too often marked by presidents for life. Mandela retired to his home in Kounou, in the Eastern Cape, where he enjoyed gardening, quiet mornings, and time with grandchildren. But he never stopped being a global moral compass. He launched the Nelson Mandela Foundation, raised millions for schools and health, and continued to speak truth to power. Whether meeting with world leaders or comforting a child with AIDS, Mandela remained the same man who had once herded cattle in the hills of Mvezo, a man rooted in dignity, guided by justice, and committed to service. Chapter 7. The Legacy Lives On. Nelson Mandela spent his final years in quiet reflection, surrounded by family, memories, and the land that had raised him. He had become more than a man. He was a global symbol of endurance, of forgiveness, of hope. But behind the public icon was still the same thoughtful, humble soul who once listened to tribal elders around a fire in Mvezo. After leaving the presidency in 1999, Mandela didn't seek power. Instead, he used his voice to champion causes that others feared to face. He launched campaigns to fight HIV/AIDS, which was devastating South Africa. He spoke out on poverty, racism, and human rights around the world. He became the loudest voice for the voiceless. But even icons grow old. By 2004, Mandela announced his full retirement from public life. "Don't call me, I'll call you," he joked, with that familiar twinkle in his eye. He spent more time at home in Kunu, a small village in the Eastern Cape. He read, laughed, and welcomed old comrades and young admirers. Yet, as his body weakened, his legacy grew stronger. Then on December 5th, 2013, Nelson Mandela passed away at the age of 95. The world paused. In South Africa, people flooded the streets, singing, dancing, mourning. His life had been a victory song, and his death was a final verse. 10 days of national mourning followed. Leaders from across the globe, presidents, kings, activists, and musicians came to pay tribute. Barack Obama called him a giant of history. Desmond Tutu said he taught a divided nation to forgive. But perhaps the most powerful tributes came from ordinary South Africans. In Soweto, a mother held her child and whispered, "You are free because of him." In Cape Town, a retired prison guard from Robben Island cried for the man he once watched over. Mandela's impact reached far beyond politics. His name became a standard for courage and humility. Schools, parks, bridges, and hospitals were named after him in more than 50 countries. The United Nations declared July 18th as Nelson Mandela International Day, a day not to celebrate, but to serve. Each year, people around the world are encouraged to give 67 minutes of service, one for every year Mandela gave to public life. He also left behind a set of values now called the Mandela Rules, UN guidelines for the humane treatment of prisoners. It was poetic. The man who had suffered so deeply behind bars had transformed that pain into protection for others. But even as his legacy soared, South Africa struggled. Inequality, corruption, and political division persisted. Some questioned whether his policy of reconciliation had come at the cost of justice. Had he forgiven too quickly? Had the land and wealth stayed in the wrong hands? Mandela had never claimed to be perfect. He once said, "I am not a saint, unless you think of a saint as a sinner who keeps on trying." He didn't promise to fix everything. He only promised to fight for the chance. And then he passed that fight on to the people. Today, his spirit lives on, not just in museums or textbooks, but in moments of courage all over the world. In young protesters who kneel for justice, in peacemakers who sit with their enemies, in prisoners who study law behind walls of silence, in leaders who choose peace when war is easier. Mandela's long walk to freedom was never just his own. It was a path he cleared for the rest of us. So now, we are the walkers, the builders, the guardians of the dream. And that dream still stands. A world where dignity is not a gift, but a right. Where freedom is not given, but born in struggle. Where peace is not weakness, but the highest form of strength. The journey continues. If Nelson Mandela taught us anything, it's this. The greatest power we hold is not in our fists or our weapons, but in our ability to choose forgiveness, to rise from hardship, and to love even those who once hurt us. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn.